This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my
new series, Parrish.
My character, Gray Parrish, was a getaway driver.
I'm retired from life. You know that.
He's in a world over his head.
Tell me about this driver job.
And he's asked to start to figure things out.
I did what you told me to.
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC+.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hey everybody, today is a beautiful day on Table for Two. We're back at the bustling Tower Bar in Los Angeles, and we're having lunch with renowned historian and New York Times bestselling author, Doug Brinkley.
Hey, welcome.
Hey, great to do this with you, my friend.
Doug is not only close friends with Sean Penn, they've spent time together in unpredictable places like New Orleans after Katrina and Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. He's also friends with George and Amal Clooney and works real close with the Clooney Foundation. A professor at Rice University with 7 honorary doctorates, Doug has written countless best-selling books and won too many awards to list, including a Grammy. I mean, the list goes on and on.
I haven't eaten anything.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, good. You'll have some lunch here with me. His latest book is called Silent Spring Revolution, and it pays tribute to the environmental crusaders of the 1960s, like John F. Kennedy and Rachel Carson. It's a fascinating read and shows how one person really can make a difference.
Now, I call you the Brad Pitt of American historians, just so
yeah,
you
like
know.
That.
We
you
are
can.
Sitting with Doug Brinkley, the Brad Pitt of American historians.
So, pour yourself a drink and grab a bite to eat, because we're having lunch with Doug Brinkley. I'm Bruce Bozzi, and this is my podcast, Table for Two.
So, Doug, your book, there's a lot here. Can you sort of encapsulate it if you were to sort of just kind of drill down for someone like myself who isn't the most in touch or educated in this area?
It's a birth of the environmental movement in my book and how they did it, how a generation forged forward, put out all the Paul Revere alarms, created Earth Day consciousness, and made us understand that we have to be planetary stewards. We failed. That generation didn't. They got a lot done in the United States legislation-wise, but we're failing them. And so we need a new wave. We're waiting for what I would call the fourth wave of environmental activism.
You know, on the cover of this book, Rachel Carson, I was like, you know, I don't really know about this woman. So I've been reading her book, Silent Spring, and there are several things that have popped out with me. And one of the things she says is, you know, now from conception to the grave, you have things in you as a result of the pesticides. And she says it's ironic that man might determine his own future by something so seemingly trivial as the choice of an insect spray. So kind of talk about that moment and who this woman was, and also in context, you know, people get stuck with thinking, Doug, as an individual, I can only do so much. But as an individual, this woman did a significant amount of things.
Yeah, I once got to be Rosa Parks's biographer, and I spent a lot of time with Mrs. Parks in Detroit and Montgomery and here in Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. And it's just one woman who created a revolution. Right. And Rachel Carson is like that.
Yes.
She grew up in Springdale, Pennsylvania, along the Allegheny River near Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And it was unregulated factories, including a glue factory that was poisoning the air and water near where her backyard was.
Right.
And so she became kind of an instinctive environmentalist, wanting to clean the Allegheny and beautify her area.
Yeah.
But she never saw an ocean as a girl, and she went to a women's college outside of Pittsburgh, but got a scholarship, fellowship, to go to Woods Hole. Woods Hole is worth knowing about. It still exists. It's on Cape Cod by Hyannisport, and it is the vortex of marine studies. If you wanted to study whales or nurse sharks or shad.
I'll have to remember that for my daughter. She loves everything marine.
Okay. Because they built on the ocean a giant red brick library in early. They started collecting there any book, any pamphlet about the seas.
Okay.
So if you wanted to go now on with the internet world, and you know you can find stuff, but back in the early 20th century, this was where you headed. And she got very interested in eels, which do migratory journeys like all the way from Africa across the ocean. So an eel in the Allegheny River could have come all the way from Africa.
Right.
That fascinated her, that they had migratory patterns, not unlike birds mm-hmm. that go long distances. Mm-hmm. And she started writing for the Baltimore Sun. She got a zoology degree at Johns Hopkins. During World War II, she started writing radio scripts and was on radio about oceans. Mm-hmm. And then she wrote in 1941, at the beginning of World War II, a book about the oceans. And she became our nation's Jacques Cousteau of prose.
Wow. I mean, I've never heard of her. Like, you would think in history class at some point,
you would.
Elementary to high school, this woman would have been.
You would have thought, and her sea books are timeless. They're not something,
yeah.
You know, Silent Spring, which we'll talk about in a minute, is of a time, but her books on the oceans are the most beautiful things ever written.
Wow.
She writes about, you know, she would travel to seashores. Her favorite milieu was the Atlantic, and so she would go her summer home in Maine, mm-hmm. Cape Cod, you know. But she loved places like Cumberland Island, Georgia, and Cape Lookout, North Carolina, along those open beach stretches, and she'd collect specimens.
Right.
So she was all of that about oceans, but she started after World War II is a defining point in my book, because Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we win the war of the United States. But at what cost to develop nuclear weapons?
Yes, and that is something that I also want to have from your historian point of view. That moment, the Truman administration decided to do that.
Well, the first bomb at Hiroshima happened, and it did create a little bit of concern with some smart people that said, no more. What are you doing?
Right.
That was the civilian population in Hiroshima. And one of the people that complained about it was Joe Kennedy, the father of future President John F. Kennedy, who wanted to see Henry Luce at Time Magazine and his local bishop in the Catholic Church say, can we get a no more of this? But Truman dropped a second. And no sooner did the detonation go off than a man named Norman Cousins wrote a long essay called Is Man Obsolete? Mm-hmm. And in that, Cousins says, this is a whole new age where now we can blow the planet
Everything
to smithereens.
Yeah.
Everything's over, what we used to know.
Right.
And unluckily for us, the United States government started testing nuclear bombs willy-nilly, blowing up the Marshall Islands, making indigenous people there sick, going into Nevada and blowing up atomic bombs. From 1945 to 1992, the United States detonated 1,054 nuclear bombs.
It's unbelievable.
So it was radioactive, but and people thought that the radioactivity or would stay maybe and only affect indigenous people in Nevada and New Mexico.
Yeah, right.
Well, it blew, and the wind blew, and people were getting radiation spikes up all the way in New York.
Yep.
And so you have, and then DDT, which was sprayed in World War II as a miracle because it killed lice, it killed ticks, and it killed mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. So if you were a soldier fighting in the Philippines or Okinawa or something, you'd get doused in it.
Yeah.
And to avoid malaria. But the scientists in our U.S. government started testing at a place called Pawtuxet, Maryland. And they said, this is a death merchant. This is it's killing fish. It's sterilizing animals. It's, all the eggshells are thinning. And yet we were spraying all across the United States, 45 to 62 crops spraying DDT everywhere.
Right.
And so there became these lanes of environmentalists. No more nuclear testing group. Rachel Carson was part of that. No more DDT spraying indiscriminately. Mm-hmm. Rachel Carson was part of that. And Rachel Carson was part of a seashore preservation movement, which said, my God, we're building condos right on the water in Miami and New Jersey. We need some fresh stretches of open beach for the public. And that seashore movement leads to John F. Kennedy creating Cape Cod National Seashore, Point Reyes National Seashore up in Marin, South Padre Island, Texas. And then they move in the Kennedy Johnson years to say Fire Island National Seashore in New York, Assateague in Maryland, Virginia, on and on. And they were smart enough in the 60s to say, let's save the Great Lakes, this great freshwater body. So we saved national parks all along the Great Lakes, like the Apostle Islands in northern Wisconsin, 22 drop-dead gorgeous islands that you can canoe and kayak to, and Sleeping Bear Dunes, these massive dunes on Lake Michigan. All of this got saved in the nick of time. All of that stuff
would have been gone.
Oh, it was on its way out.
Everything gone. I mean, it's fascinating. It's happening today too, Doug. It's like the divide. It's like there are the people that understand that and see that, and there are people that are looking to develop it and make money off of it or what have you. And she, as the individual, Rachel Carson, I know there are a number of things that got passed through legislation that have affected all of us in a positive way as the individual, like the Clean Air Act.
Well, if we were coming for a lunch like this in, say, 1960, and right in you know, Hollywood, right. You know, West Hollywood, if we came here, it would have been pollution everywhere.
Right.
In downtown L.A., the smog, you couldn't breathe.
Right.
And Pasadena was particularly bad.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't, people were getting sick just being in Los Angeles. And yet, this was paradise. You were supposed to come to Southern California because it was the prettiest place on the
on Earth. Exactly. In 1977, first time I ever came to L.A., I was with my parents. We were flying in. It was so smoggy, the plane couldn't land. They had to divert it to Vegas. We had to spend the night in Vegas and then fly the next morning. That's disgusting.
Disgusting. It was that bad.
Yeah.
And what's neat, I write about in the book, there's a group of women in Pasadena, the Smogateers, that would hold protest rallies. And a lot of citizens groups rose up. And there became we needed to detect, where's this smog coming from? What are the sources?
Right.
And there were two different ways to think about. One is stationary industrial source pollution and bad at dirty incinerator, a factory. That got started getting cleaner in 1963 with the Clean Air Act of 63, passed right after Kennedy was killed in Dallas in December. Then there was a second act, 1970 December, and Nixon signed that. And that second act went after automobiles. And Nixon, for all of his deep flaws, had an ear for constituent politics.
Right.
And on the environment, in 1968, he was running. He did not care when he ran for president about the environment at all.
Right.
But there was a lot of noise in the media culture, you know, and showing dirty lakes and dying Lake Erie and dead birds. But Nixon was president only days when the Santa Barbara oil spill happened. And Santa Barbara, paradise.
Yeah, you talk about the significance of that.
Yeah, wiped out, you know, just black smudge goo everywhere, birds stuck in oil, unable to get out. And Nixon started seeing this happening. And on January 1, 1970, Nixon at San Clemente signs NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act. After that went down, Nixon gave a State of the Union address January 1970. And in that address, one third of it was about the environment. Now Earth Day came, and Earth Day was
Still exists.
Still exists. In 70, it was epic. To everybody. Walter Cronkite covered on, it was like the biggest thing, like today's Earth Day. Everybody got off from school, every college camp. Yeah, it was the deal. And a lot of things happened. The music became big out of that Earth Day.
Right.
Marvin Gaye, Mercy Me, The Ecology, right. Joni Mitchell, big, you know, Yellow Taxi, Neil Young writing ecological ballads, Pete Seeger, the folk singer, working to save the Hudson River. So musical artists became environmentally inclined.
That's significant.
Yeah.
I mean, that late 60s or that 70s genre of Laurel Canyon music, of that whole, all those artists, that's when also I think the magic was happening in Los Angeles. So interesting that it was.
Yes. And, they took the environment as a big issue here.
Yeah.
California was the leader in environmental stewardship and consciousness.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome back to Table for Two. We've just ordered lunch here at the Tower Bar, and Doug is telling me all about his new book, Silent Spring Revolution. It's a snapshot of the extraordinary people who, early on, insisted on protecting the earth and its resources. So let's dive deeper into what inspired Doug to write it.
So, I mean, this book is huge. How long did it take you to write this, and when did you start to sort of formulate the significance of these particular people?
Well, the great part for me was, unlike when you deal with the Roosevelts, Theodore and Franklin, they were real environmentalists.
Right.
They're a gold standard. They really prioritized it. Less so Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. But they were responsive. And what they responded to was Rachel Carson. She was like Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin about slavery. Or there was Upton Sinclair wrote a book, The Jungle, about dirty meatpacking factories in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Rachel Carson blew a very loud alarm in Silent Spring that said, we're destroying the planet.
Right.
And by our arrogance and our conceits and by our greed and by our consumerism run amok, we're not regulating things properly. We're not being land and water stewards. And so I knew that she would be the center of my book. And yet I wanted to have an ensemble cast.
Right.
And her relationship with John F. Kennedy is interesting because if Jack Kennedy did not back her action, she was, he said, I'm going to put a science panel. I'm going to hire the best people. And we're going to see whether her book holds up or not. That's the obvious thing to do.
Okay.
And the scientists said, oh my God, Rachel Carson nailed it. It's all accurate.
Wow.
And so that helped. You have a president now backing a writer like Rachel Carson. And then I noticed Lady Bird Johnson, a first lady, married to Lyndon Johnson. She was a hardened environmentalist. Particularly, she was interested in wildfire conservation, but also she was opposed to what they call the uglies or vulgarization of landscapes. Mm-hmm. She wanted to make sure parts of America stayed beautiful,
sure,
more in a pristine way. And she would travel all over as First Lady and go down the Rio Grande River in a raft, or, you know, go on kayaking in the Snake River of Idaho, or go up to the Redwoods up in Mendocino, Humboldt County, California. Mm-hmm. So she was an activist environmental First Lady, which was helpful because she carried a big celebrity spotlight.
Sure, extremely. Yeah.
And then Hollywood. You know, I write in the book that Walt Disney was a Republican, but he was an unusual Republican that he had that in the sense that his big love was critters. You know, he liked little animals. Like when he lived here up in California, you know, other people might complain about deer in their backyard, Bambi in their backyard, or whatever. He never did. He saw the potential animation of watching these animals up close, their habits, their movements. And so he did a group of films called Disney True Adventures, which would run. And it had a profound effect because he would show the life of a coyote. And up until Disney, people in all over America put cyanide to poison the coyotes because they were considered a vermin and an enemy to the ranchers, to cattle, sure, the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And Disney makes them cuddly pups living with mom, rolling down a hill, you know. So there became in the 60s, we've got to save this Noah's Ark of species.
Yep.
That how we're lucky we can still do it. We can save the manatee in Florida or the Florida panther. We can save a condor in Arizona or the, you know, spotted owl. So the celebrity becomes
a big, big deal.
Very big.
And your friendships with Sean Penn and George Clooney and Brad Pitt, so, you know, tell us about those relationships.
I'm very close with Sean. Sean Penn is a good friend of mine, and I'm always proud of him. And I tell him I'm proud of him. I'm proud that he, beyond being this extraordinary actor who can, you know, do Milk or Mystic River, and his resume is so long. The other side of him, which is an activist side, when I was in New Orleans for Hurricane Katrina, he'd go down to film in New Orleans a lot, Sean. In fact, he has tattooed on his side NOLA, New Orleans, you know, Louisiana, on his arm.
You wrote a book based on your experience with Sean about Katrina, and it also comes up as a question to me, like, why was that not the moment that everyone just said, okay, this is a problem?
That should have been.
But, okay.
And we were living, I was living in Katrina, through Katrina, stayed in at Tulane, and Sean came in. I evacuated after it, and he came in, and we insinuated ourselves past roadblocks of police, you know, and we were in the darkened city, and we stayed together in this, I knew one home of a guy who had a generator, and so Sean and I would stay there, and then Matt Taibbi, a writer from Rolling Stone, was around for a while, but we would get a boat through Nick Robertson of CNN, and I was able to procure a little boat. So we would go out and do rescue missions. And, you know, it was amazing to me because Sean got on the boat and hop in. But some of these people lost everything.
Yeah.
They're in water. They're out sitting on a front porch stoop with water surrounding them. And suddenly they would look up and say, Sean Penn, I saw you in...
I read that you said that, right?
Yeah, cut right.
I mean, like, the baby's up in the attic.
Baby's up in the attic, and you're talking about Sean's movies while your whole life is gone down the tubes. But we would bring people up to St. Charles Avenue and then to Arturo Hospital. And, you know, he's a natural leader, Sean, and he has a great leadership. He could have been a colonel or a captain in the Army.
Completely.
Because he's able to mobilize people and move. He does logistics surprisingly well. And so after that, we just started doing different things. So I wrote a portrait of Sean, a long profile for Vanity Fair in Haiti. It was only one of my visits to Haiti, but I visited Sean a bunch of times down there, helping, doing what I could do as a writer, but also by profiling Sean in Vanity Fair about what he was doing in Haiti, bring consciousness to it. And I collect friends through Sean like that. There's a General Ken Keene, who was the head of the Southern Command in Haiti. And I was with Sean. It was this, you know, strange Haitian night in Port-au-Prince, and Sean's smoking his cigarette. And we went together to go meet the general running the thing. And Sean puts his cigarette behind his back like that. The general doesn't see it. And he goes, Sean, smoke. That's a perfectly good cigarette, and it should not go to waste. And started right. smoking it, and they got along really well. And here I watched Sean in bed with the military in a way yeah. that was really interesting and helpful.
It seems like that's unique, like that you throw yourself into it right at the front lines. What motivates you?
Maybe both Sean and I are frustrated. we want to be like combat reporters. Like we want to be like Ernest Hemingway or Stephen Crane. And
do you ever get scared when you're in those situations?
No, because I really take care of myself. You know, I do, but I'm so cautious. Like when I was in Haiti. Everybody else was telling me, like, if somebody got sick from a shower,
yeah.
you know, from the water.
I always wonder about
it. And so I was like doing bottled water, sponge bath. And I wasn't risking, you know. I saw others like, oh, it was only one person. It's like, one's enough, man. Right. I ain't going in that shower. So I have preservation strategies. Okay. I'm not quite brave.
Good.
But
you're very brave.
Yeah, but, you know, we've had fun and gone many other places. I went with Sean and Christopher Hitchens to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. We traveled all over there. We interviewed Hugo Chavez there. I've been with Sean to Cuba, and we would go. So it became part of a routine. But more than that, I just he's just such a warm-hearted, wonderful person, Sean, when you get to really know him.
Yeah.
He's a mensch and a beautiful friend and never forgets me and includes me in things. You know, here I am teaching at Rice University, and if he hears I'm coming out here and he's doing some big gala, he'll just like suddenly plug me in, you know, right. like I'm at the A table, right. and it's like,
well, no, you've earned a seat at the A table, technically. And Sean, I had the, you know, when Sean was really pushing the vaccinations here in Los Angeles, I had a real incredible afternoon with him where I met him in Brentwood and I drove in his pickup truck and I really saw him in action, just as he's smoking his cigarettes and we're driving to Dodger Stadium. And then I, you know, watched him have the meeting with the team and then go to the field and really see what was happening and then go back and sort of hear his regroup. And I really at one point just looked at to my left in the car, and there's Sean. He's all, you know, weathered and tan and smoking. And I just knew this was such a significant moment of watching an incredible individual make change, which
absolutely.
We keep going back to. Individuals can do things.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Thank you for joining us on Table for Two. Doug is not only an award-winning author, but he's also a distinguished historian and has an eye not only on the past, but on what's happening today too. I'm curious how Doug thinks we will look back at this unprecedented moment in history.
All of us have had the good fortune now to see with these telescopes that are now showing us what's out there. And then you also remember the finite time we're on this planet from conception to grave. And it astounds me that we don't make the right choices and we're in this war with each other when these companies make a lot of money. The economic divide, it gets me nuts. And so you feel there's hope.
I have to, because I teach young people. And so, you know, Woody Guthrie used to talk about I'm a hope machine.
Yes.
And I try to use that. Like, I've got to promote hope. And I also learned from the people I wrote about in the book, environmentalists of the 60s that got results.
Right.
You got to make it fun. A lot of students are very worried about climate change, as they should be.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news is some of them are freaking out about it, saying, my God, the planet is doomed. Everything, it's lost.
Right.
And so you try to say, don't get sick, you know,
right.
Stay psychologically healthy, stay physically healthy, and let's get you going on a project. And it may not be getting off of fossil fuels. It might be a smaller thing of protecting a local bayou. Or saving an open space.
Start small.
Start small and get the taste of victory.
Right.
Win some local environmental issue.
Right.
Stop a project that's going to be detrimental to an estuary or a butterfly habitat, whatever you choose. And then you'll meet people. You'll network with people. And that network just has to grow. But it's not going to... There is a spiritual side to the natural world, and we're going to need all hands on deck to save the planet. If you can find somebody that's angry about this 1% of corporate greed and extraction industry, monsters that are just ravaging the planet and they don't care, you're going to have to find a very big alliance of Davids to take on that Goliath.
And I think it's... great to hear you say, from your perspective, to find the hope and keep it and lean into like the small wins, because the small wins are going to get us.
The good news about the Generation Z, the young people of today, I think they see the electric car, for whatever Tesla and other companies are, they see it's doable.
Right.
This is the first generation that's growing up that knows somebody that has an electric car.
Right.
You know, they may not be able to afford it. They don't have it themselves, but they're saying, I can feel that that's going to happen.
Right.
And I think that gives them a little extra impetus, this generation right now, that we can maybe do this. It might be, Bob Dylan has a song called Up to Me, which was left off of Blood on the Tracks.
Right.
But it's on one of his bootlegs. But, Dylan says, nobody else is singing the song I want to hear.
Right.
So I guess it's up to me.
Yeah.
Or that Michael Jackson face in the mirror kind of thing. But,
uh-huh.
You got to sometimes say, look, it's about me. I'm going to do what I can do without getting sick, without being psychologically a basket case. I'm going to live a healthy life, but I'm going to prioritize environmental stewardship any way I can. And I'm willing to do small victories with my eye on the big one.
Do you think there'll be a time that you, the historian, looks back on this time, the people that will be alive looking back at this time will look at it and be like, how will they perceive this time?
I think there'll be a narrative about in the 1950s with the discovery of DNA,
mm-hmm.
human makeup, of our makeup. And at the same time, the computer chip came, microchip and Texas Instruments. And at the same time, we started aiming for the moon with technology, using our missile war capacity in the NASA to do a moonshot. And technology became the god. People like Aldous Huxley warned about this in Brave New World.
Yep.
In Huxley's book, you would bless yourself with the T of the Model T. But now you would bless yourself with the T of technology.
Yeah.
And there's a race going on between the people that don't care what's happening, thinks technology will fix it. Well, so what if there's wildfires here? Technology will figure it out.
Right.
And so a lot of people are praying at the altar of technology. And that has benefits. Look, when I get sick and I'm going to a hospital, I'm so glad of new heart, open heart surgery technology.
Yep.
I thank you, God, for that technology. And sometimes, you know, when I'm lost and I can go on GPS, I'm like, thank God for GPS.
Right. You say to yourself, oh my God, how did I used to do this?
Right. You know? So we all understand it, but we also need to be suspicious, to take a pace back. That's what Rachel Carson was telling people. You're just spraying this DDT all over. It's killing people. Oh, Cesar Chavez started the Mexican-American movement with pesticides. Okay. Let's take a break here. Let's see what's going on. Let's get more data before we move. And we opened up the Wild West of social media with no data. We just opened the doors.
Everyone just ran in. As a historian, in your view, is it your job to be unbiased, an unbiased reporter, or is it to be an evaluator of the past who is not unbiased, but who is responsible for highlighting the important themes and ideas for the rest of us and building a morality out of it?
I've learned to have two hats. One is I try to be just like if you went to a doctor, you're just doing your diagnosis, or a judge in a law case. Historians trying to do a judge, I try to say this is what happened. But on the environment, when you see the planet being destroyed, I feel I have a moral obligation, which is ahead of my professional obligation, to raise whatever alarm bells I can to say that we are going to have to find a new wave. We're going to have a new silent spring revolution where people from all walks of life said enough. We're done with fossil fuels.
Right.
And I know it's global and it's difficult. I don't believe China's going to help us. I'm good friends with John Kerry. He was trying hard to do diplomacy with China on climate. It's almost impossible.
Yep.
India polluting. But we can start it here at home. We can start it in California and let it grow. And eventually, the United States is shown to be such a dominant country. Maybe we are the country that shows the world that we're done with fossil fuels, that it's an antiquated form of
energy.
Yeah,
I mean, we're going to have to take the lead.
We're going to have to be the lead.
Right.
And that's just it. And it's hard, but it can grow. The movement has to grow. I wrote in this book, it's not just Rachel Carson, a scientist, author, or William O. Douglas, Supreme Court Justice, but there were Republicans, there were filmmakers, there were actors, there were artists. We all pitch in, school teachers on Earth Day teaching it. I mean, everybody today knows what ecology is.
Yes.
I mean, that was a moment. So this generation, the baby boom generation that gets you know, criticized a lot, actually on the environment at least created sustainable ideas for we do with air, water quality, sewage treatment plants, save some species that were going extinct. We moved the bar forward, but since then, it's been, and what happened with after the Endangered Species Act passed in 1973, that passed the Senate 92-0.
Mm.
Very progressive legislation to save wildlife. That same year, they had the Arab oil embargo. And the OPEC countries said, the Arab countries united and did price gouging on us. And the American people, like recently, are complaining about high gasoline at the pumps, inflation.
Yeah.
Why aren't we energy independent? And you started getting the oil gas lobby organizing in a way with the extraction industries of all kinds, chemical industries, to form a counterpunch to the environmentalists. The good news was the environmental movement got a win in the 60s and 70s and made a difference. But then they got muted because of the power of money of these oil and gas people shut it down.
As our lunch comes to a close, I'm comforted by Doug's optimism that if we act now, we can still turn things around. But when the stakes are so high, what actions can we take to protect the future? So, Doug, you know, you do have hope, which is so good to hear. What can the individual do? What can I do to help this along?
I think if you have the economic means and could speed up the transfer to an electric car, do it. If you can make less of a carbon footprint, do it. But look, we're busy. Not everybody's keeping tabs of their carbon footprint, nor can they. And I don't want people should, you can't shame people. We shouldn't be shaming people on the environment. Look, it's a big mess going on there. So find something that you like. I like to tell students the great book by Henry David Thoreau, Walden's Pond, and he fell in love with the pond. Mm-hmm. And you read Walden, and I would ask people, what's your Walden? If I ask Bruce, what's a place that you've been in all your travels that you just love, that speaks to you in the natural world? Mm-hmm. Be a custodian of that place. Put your heart there and say, I just love, for whatever reason, the Great Basin National Park in Nevada, or I just love the Big Sur coastline. Take the time, join a friends group there, talk to other people that love that place, and you'll become a watchdog for a particular area that we need to hold those heirlooms down while all of this is in transition right now.
That's great. Be a custodian of the place you love. Protect. It's like being taking care of your home, your family. Be that custodian.
Yeah, you know, when Dr. Seuss and the Lorax, you know, I speak for the trees.
Yep.
You need to speak for that one area that meant a lot to you. I love the Hudson River Valley, so I'm working with Scenic Hudson and Get Up. And what can we do to make the river cleaner? Just one, because I'd like all rivers to be clean, but I can be overwhelmed.
Right.
And, and don't beat up on it. We're don't punish ourselves. Just be positive, full of love, and find a place you love and work to protect it.
And I feel like, you know, the Giving Tree, that book, you know, at the end of the book, when it's just a stump and he says, I have nothing more to give, there's such a powerful lesson in that for us today.
Absolutely.
And I don't know where on the tree we're at. Hopefully we're not at the stump.
Yeah, we're not at the stump. That's the good news. Okay. That's the glass half full view of it.
Okay, we're not at the stump. All right.
But the stump, I'm looking at that stump.
Right. We're getting close to the stump.
I used to be the literary executor, of Hunter Thompson's estate, the wild guy and all my, and everybody thinks drugs and alcohol and Hunter is interesting. The part I liked of Hunter was I went with him. He was in Woody Creek, Colorado, and joined the local Woody Creek council meeting. It's all these like just local people. There's Hunter with his hat.
Yeah.
And he would do all the little things that we're not going to let the gravel pit on the road. We're not going to do because he loved that area. And he, no, that's an elk range. You're not going to do it. And you know, he just did his little part. And that made me see him as a citizen.
Yeah.
You know, that's a high calling. That's important. A citizen.
That's really important.
And out here, what you do, Bruce, and or just an actor like Leonardo DiCaprio, what he's been doing with ocean awareness, I've gotten to watch up close, and it makes a difference. He can, when he goes to Washington, people wake up. John Kerry was once tried to ask me to get Leonardo to come to a big ocean summit. I was like, I'm not going to get him, but I went and wrote an email to Michael Medavoy, and Medavoy is friends, but you know. One thing happened to another, and Leo said, I guess I need to be there for this. And we said, yep.
Yeah.
So he showed up, and not only did he give an incredible speech, but Leo gave him like $1 million check on the spot, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And, you know, so a lot of the people in the Hollywood community, you should see yourself as the energizing force for the new environmental movement, that you've got a lot of clout, power, and media access, and so use it.
Yeah.
And to combat climate change.
Well, everyone should read this book because I always feel like you have to understand the foundation to go to the next level of it. And, you know, you can't just take an amazing photograph. You have to learn the process.
Yes.
And we've lost the way. So to get back there, this book is an amazing book. It should be taught in classes.
That's what I wanted it to. I think if you read it, you'll say, optimistically, we can do this now. We got a big burden, but we can do it. Right. They took on these challenges.
Yeah.
I mean, the bald eagle was almost extinct. There are handfuls left.
Yeah, I remember.
And we brought it back.
Right.
And, you know, we can do a lot. Hey, Lake Erie was dead, and it's now alive. Yeah. Cuyahoga River on fire. Now it's a national park.
Right.
We can do things. And so be hopeful. Read this as like a roadmap to 21st century new environmental wave waiting for.
It's been a pleasure having lunch with you. And thank you, everyone, for pulling up a chair today and having lunch.
What they didn't see is that I unfortunately went for the pizza and left my kale salad to wilt in front of me.
Yeah.
Which just tells you my bad eating habits right off the bat.
Well, thank you, Doug. I appreciate your time. I appreciate lunch.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Table for Two with Bruce Bozzi is produced by iHeartRadio, 737 Park, and Airmail. Our executive producers are Bruce Bozzi and Nathan King. Table for Two is researched and written by Bridget Arsenault. Our sound engineers are Paul Bowman and Alyssa Midgaff. Table for Two's LA production team is Danielle Romo and Lorraine Virez. Our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our talent booking is by Jane Sarkin. Special thanks to Amy Sugarman, Uni Scher, Kevin Uvain, Bobby Bauer, Allison Cantor-Graber, Barbara and Jen, and Jeff Klein and the staff at the Tower Bar in the world-famous Sunset Tower Hotel. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.